Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaronshow.com. I'm at Aaron Show on Twitter. You can go to the Facebook and type in the little search thingamajigger, the Matthew Aaron Show. You click like, you'll be following us. Let's see, on iTunes, you can join our thousands of subscribers on there. Stitcher, BBC, listen to them, then listen to us. And then today I have on the show Gavin Hood, who is directed Ender's Game. You've also probably seen maybe Sosti or Rendition or, of course, Wolverine, the Origins movie that came out a few years ago. And Kevin MacDonald will be joining me from How I Live Now. And he's the director of that film. He's also the director of Touching the Void, Marley, Mick, Life in a Day, State of Play, what's the Channing Tatum movie, The Eagle, Last King of Scotland, of course. And he's an Academy Award winner, and he will be joining us as well. I'm going to play a clip from Oprah's Own right now, before I get to the interviews, because I think this is just, it's funny for me, and that's all I really care about as I sit here half naked in my house doing a show today. So this is Patti LaBelle on Oprah. I'm not going to explain much of it other than I think Patti LaBelle's fucking awesome, and it's the funniest shit I've heard in a while. I love it. So here's Patti LaBelle on Oprah from this week. It's really fascinating for me.
But every performer knows an Apollo audience is not afraid to boo a future star right off the...
So you never got booed here?
What?
What?
Girl, who are you talking to?
You know, I had the Legends Ball and honored you and others, you know, great African-American women who had impacted my life as legends. Do you see yourself as one? As a legend, do you recognize yourself as
yes,
a legend?
Yes, I really do.
You do.
Because I've had
have
so
you
many...
accepted it?
What? I have a lot of people to come up to me. Can we take this photo? Can you talk to my mother on the phone? I said I don't do the phone because I don't want no germs, baby. But tell her I said hey. I'm a district. Hey, hello, mother. I'll do that.
That's where you draw the line.
I'm not
talking
speaking
on, the phone.
On your instrument.
Yes.
And I don't even have a cell phone. You know I'm not going to talk to somebody else.
I read that you don't have a cell phone.
I don't tweet, Twitter, email, Facebook, lookbook.
None.
No kind of book. No, nothing. I have a landline phone at my home. You have that number. That's the only phone I have. That's the only phone I want.
Do you feel like you're removed from the world?
Heck no.
You don't.
Why should I? If my phone rang every day like everybody else around me, I would lose my mind.
Really?
Yeah, I don't play that.
You don't play that?
I mean, don't play that. No cell phones.
What makes you happy now?
Gosh, I guess flowers and walking my little shih tzu and walking in my pool. I can't swim, but I walk for the... It makes me happy now. And there was a time in my life...
So you just get in the pool and walk?
I'm not swimming. I don't even have a bathing suit.
So what are you walking in?
A t-shirt and my pants.
Okay.
My short pants.
Okay.
And I'm in... Who's going to see me?
Okay. It's your pool.
Nobody's there.
Mm-hmm.
I walk the little dog. I clean my house, although I have help.
I was going to say, you clean your house.
What? I'm on the floor getting spot. I can't stand a dirty house.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a cleaning fanatic.
Mm-hmm. You took care of the neighbor's children?
Yes, the two brothers who we adopted when I was
so
married.
So you ended up with five children?
Five children. And Zori said it was okay. I said, Zori, do you mind if I bring other kids in the house? No, Mom. He didn't mind sharing me with others.
Oh. That's great.
He's such a not hold on kid.
And now he's your manager. How does that
oh,
work?
Oh, that's awful. Girl, if only you knew. Can I have a swig of water?
Take some water.
Okay, keep going. Down.
I think when it was about 2000 something,
mm-hmm.
you came on the show, and all of a sudden you were single. And we talked briefly about this,
and you had a problem with that. You had an attitude.
Did I have an attitude?
Girl, you were about to cut him down.
Do you think you'd ever get married again? You know, I just was at Tina's wedding.
It was beautiful. Her green underpinning dress with the lace on top or something.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Beautiful. Congratulations, Tina, darling, but Patty's not going to go there. Ever again.
Ever.
Ever. Never. Why would I at 69? Well, she's 73.
73.
I know, but I don't want that.
You don't want it?
No. I've been shut down, run down, talked about, dogged out, but that never stopped me from being the true me that's here and will be here. I can never not be happy about my life.
Mm-hmm.
All the things that I've been in and out of and through, I'm so strong now, Oprah. I don't need to worry anymore about anything.
Mm-hmm. Nothing to prove?
I have nothing to prove. Nothing to prove. You've done so many wonderful things for me because you like me.
Mm-hmm. I care about you.
I know you care
mm-hmm.
so much. And when people say, how's Oprah? I said, meet her one day yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Patti LaBelle's the greatest ever. oh, homie, don't play that. Girl gets in the pool. You know, Oprah always goes a little hood sister when she's with, you know, someone else that's black. And I do that, too. And people always rip on me for it. And I'm like, you know, I could go hood sister, too. And Oprah's talking about the pool. And Patti LaBelle goes into the pool. And I swear... she wanted to say panties, but she didn't. She's too classy to say panties, so she said short pants. And, yeah, Patti LaBelle is a legend, and she knows it. And I think that's great. She's the best ever. I'm going to kick off today's show with the interview with Gavin Hood from Ender's Game, the director of Ender's Game. We talk about a lot of things, including the origins of the film, the story itself. And we talk about the controversy surrounding Orson Scott Card and his views on gay marriage and his views towards gay people in general, which I think is really fascinating. And Gavin gives a hell of an interview. And so is Kevin McDonald. Today's show, these two interviews are going to blow your mind. I think you're really going to enjoy them. Right before I get to that, let me just tell you, I've been apartment hunting in Chicago because I'm going back to film that my film. So here's basically the way Chicago apartments work. Basically, like every big city, you could pay $1,000 a month to stay in the nicest apartment ever. It'll have, like, there'll be a bar downstairs. It's like staying at a hotel. You'll get, like, 300 square feet. Or you can have a big apartment in, like, the shittiest neighborhood or in the, not even the neighborhood. Or it's an old apartment with a lot of space, 600, 700 square feet for $1,000. But, you know, what do you do? I mean, it's so annoying that you could stay at a really nice place for $1,000, but it's like living in a hotel forever. So now you have to kind of sacrifice the quality of where you're staying for staying in an older place. And there's this level of confidence you now have to have because you're like, well, man, one bedroom's better than a studio. Who wants to take anyone back to a studio? You know, but at the same time, man, it's impressive to take someone back to this apartment complex you're staying at. It's such a conundrum. I don't even know how I feel about it. I guess you want more space, right? You want more space because you want to have your people over and you want to do your thing. I don't know how people can live in studio apartments. And I'm sorry for people that do live in studio apartments that are listening. I'm not insulting you. I just literally do not know how you can do that. I mean, I need a room. I need a room. I feel like a studio apartment is like living in an office with a shower and a small kitchen. I don't know. Just don't get it. But pardon me. The nice thing about doing this from home is I could smoke. I just don't get the studio apartment living. So I think I'm going to have to end up getting a bigger place at an older place. And just have the confidence to say, listen, sweetheart, I could stay at a better place. Okay, I could stay at a fancier place. I could be in the Gold Coast. I can be in the Loop for the amount of money I pay. but we'll be asses to elbows no matter what we're doing in here. So, I mean, it's nice. How do you even have a couch in a studio apartment? You really can't. If you have a queen-size bed, you're done. You're done. Maybe you get a nightstand, and then your room's full. You're full. And, I mean, that is your living area. I mean, what do you do when you're eating dinner? You got no space for a table. How do you have people over? I mean, you can't have a couch. You can't have a couch. You can't even have a love seat. You can't have a love seat in your home. I don't know. I don't get it. All right. I'm going to play this interview with Gavin Hood and relight this cigarette that's now, like, you know, burning out. Ender Games, the film. It's in theaters now. And this is Gavin and I talking last week, right before the film came out. And Out Magazine, I believe, no, The Advocate, did an article with Gavin, an interview with Gavin and some of the producers about the gay controversy. And it was some of the most softball questions I ever heard. So I thought I'd follow up on that as well. That's going to be in this interview. So give it a listen, and I'll be back in about 30 minutes to introduce Kevin McDonald. And maybe I'll go shower right now, because I am sitting here, like, pretty much naked, just staring at a computer screen, talking to y'all. This is Matthew Aaron. Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I'm here with Gavin Hood, the director of Ender's Game. You've also seen his work in such films as Rendition and Sosti and Wolverine. Gavin, very, very, very nice to speak to you today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Good to speak to you, too.
Yes, I'm a little nervous because I got to tell you, I got a lot to talk about with this film. First of all, 28 years in development, this film. Why you, and how happy are you that it's just done with?
Well, that's a weighty question. Why me? I guess I was sent the book 5 years ago by my agent. I hadn't heard of it until I read it then. I read it. I thought it was a great book with great themes of compassion and tolerance and also this incredible struggle within this lead character of Ender Wiggin between his capacity for great compassion and empathy, but his equal but opposite capacity for aggression and violence. And I thought that, in a sense, all these dual emotions that we have as human beings are sort of distilled into this one character. You know, we as human beings are capable of great compassion, and we're capable of terrible atrocities. And so Ender is a complicated kid in search of, if you like, a kind of moral compass of his own, and flung about in this world where he's sent to a military school to train in space, and where the agenda of the school is that he should become a warrior. And his personal development as a human being is not necessarily their central concern. So I thought the book had great themes and ideas, and it's also set in space with these amazing visual opportunities for a director to create this amazing battle room and these fantastic visuals out in space with space battles. So it's epic, but it's also an intimate character story. So I said I would be very interested in doing the adaptation, and my agent sent me along to a meeting with producers Gigi Pritzker and Linda McDonough. And I got the job, and then I realized, wow, this book is even trickier than I thought when I first read it. And it took about a year and a bit to get the script into before we even started raising the money on it.
Well, yeah, you and I want to talk about two things. One, I understand. I mean, this is my understanding, because you did something very well in this movie that I think you do very well in all your movies. Is, first of all, themes of questioning authority, no matter what movie that you tend to do, they all seem to have themes of questioning authority, which I find fascinating because you're a military man. Now, the military stuff in this movie is so great. I mean, I would say it's better than what's even... You present the military so well in this movie. Why is that a recurring theme, though, in all your films, though, questioning authority?
Well, that's a really, thank you. I've not been asked that question before, and I think it's very it's very accurate. I think because I was drafted at the age of 17 in 1981 into the South African military at a time when it was a very turbulent time. The Cold War was for us a very hot war in Africa. We had CIA guys backing our forces against Soviet Union-backed forces in Angola and in Mozambique. There was the struggle for resources of Southern Africa, the diamonds, the oil fields, usual stuff of war, you know, oil and so on. And yet it was also at the height of the nationalist government trying to hold on to power as an apartheid government backed by Reagan and Thatcher because they were afraid that the Soviets would take control of Southern Africa. So a very toxic, complex, messy mix to find yourself drafted into. And I think I thought that I would just go in and kind of muddle my way through and get out. And, of course, that was naive and stupid because you don't muddle your way through 2 years in the military. And I did lose a particular friend in the war in Angola. And it made me question authority, to answer your question, in a big way. It made me question the nature of the conflict that we were involved in, that war is often messy, the politics behind it probably even messier. And I realized, I think, much like the character at the end of the film, that it doesn't matter what your parents or your country or your military officers, whatever input they're giving you is input that you have to take, but ultimately you have to find your own way and find your own moral compass in the world and make your own decisions about what you think is right and wrong and where you will find your own place in this complicated world that we live in. And so, if you like, it was a major awakening politically in many ways. And I suppose that that's what runs through my work, is that we simply have to question what goes on around us. Otherwise, we become mindless tools in someone else's agenda, you know?
Well, I think this is what makes you a great director and what gets you some great projects is, I think the key to making a great film is you have to question something. And so, I mean, I think that always leads you in the right direction. With this film, there's a couple changes that were made, and I know you ended up writing the film, and I know this film's been written 50 times. Did you read any of the older drafts, or did you want Ignorance is Bliss? I don't want to know anything anyone else wrote. I'm going to read the book. I'm going to write it the way I want to write it. How did that process go?
That's a great question. Ignorance was kind of bliss, I think. It was compelled because at the time that Gigi Pritzker optioned the rights to the book, Warner Brothers had let the rights go, but they still owned the scripts that they developed. So I was told that they had no deal with Warner Brothers and that whatever scripts had been developed with their property, and I was not allowed to look at them. Well, so I simply went into a job interview and pitched an approach to the book, which, as you know, is a complicated piece in many ways, but part of the difficulty in adapting it is the fact that it is very much about what goes on in the mind of this young character. Beautifully described, it's beautifully described what he's thinking, what he's feeling, what he's emotionally struggling with, something which we've been talking about now. This struggle that N has, and that is a tricky thing to translate into a screenplay where you can use a certain amount of voiceover before it becomes tedious, and you really want to construct scenes where characters are in conflict with each other and that the reaction that you see on an actor, a good actor's face, tells you what they're thinking and feeling in a way that an author might in a book have to describe through various paragraphs. So although we can't do certain things that books can do, we have living, breathing actors that if they're good, and I believe Asa Butterfield is fantastic in this film and up against Harrison Ford, you sense that conflict, that inner conflict from the actor through performance. So really I was tasked with adapting the book myself. I wasn't allowed to look at the other material, and my approach was, if we're to get into the mind of this young kid, he really needs to be in every scene in the movie. Yeah. And people were like, are you sure? And I said, I really believe that's the approach in terms of adapting the book. I need to put the audience with Ender and stay with him, because he's a tricky kid to wrap your head around. He does some things that are not pleasant, and he does other things that are amazing. And in order to identify with him, we need to really be with him as much as possible. So there are only a couple of scenes in the film that he's not in, and those are scenes between Colonel Graf and Major Anderson, and right. In those scenes they talk about him.
Right.
So that you really are trying to experience this film through the mind of this young boy who is on the verge of becoming a man, but is really still trying to please authority figures as much as possible, gradually realizing that he has to question what he's being asked.
Right. Before we get to the changes that were slightly made from the book to the film, I did want to ask you, when you're dealing with creative, when you're dealing with the studios, did you ever have a point in time a studio tell you,
Why can't he just blow up the alien at the end? Why can't he...
You've heard this story. Yes,
is this
we did.
True, though? Is this true? Hey?
Yes, okay. It's really true. This film with certain studios, and a particular studio executive did say at one point, we really love this idea of this kid fighting these aliens, but, quote, why can't he just kick the aliens' ass? That's how these movies work. And we did go outside into the parking lot, my producers and I.
Uh-oh. Yeah, hello.
I didn't have to say any of that because my producer, Zipritska, said, well, we won't be able to make it here. We're going to have to raise the money independently. And that's what happened. So, look, it's a complicated book to adapt. I think that's what the thrill of it is. You know, it gave me two things as a director. It gave me a chance to do big visuals and have a lot of fun with these incredible space scenes in space. But it also is the opportunity to try and get to grips with a complicated character-driven story. And
that's right.
And that's what I like about it, like the combination of those two things.
Well, yeah, Asa was fantastic in this, but I also want to say Harrison Ford is the best he's been in years in this film. He's great.
Thank you. Yeah, I
just thought you did a great job with actors. You do a really good job with actors. I'm very curious how a military man like you got involved as an actor in this business, became a writer, director. I mean, this is all very fascinating to me, your career.
My resume is a mishmash, isn't it? No, it's much simpler than it sounds. I grew up with parents who were involved in the theater as actors, and my father is a set designer and director in theater. And so I grew up around actors and going to the theater a lot. And we didn't have any television in South Africa until 1976 when I was 13 years old. So I'd never seen TV. And part of that was because you're dealing with an authoritarian government that doesn't want its population to have real access to the outside world. They've got a message and they want you to stick with that. So when television arrived, it was on for 2 hours a night and there was like the Brady Bunch and then the national anthem, you know. So we went to theater and I was fortunate to be, that's where there was sort of intelligent plays being written by people like Athol Fugard, who, as you know, I adapted his novel in Tsotsi,
right,
10 years ago. And so my experience was to be around actors, be around theater, be around that kind of writing. And then we watched 16 mil home movies at home, and that was our access to the outside world. And I guess I thought that it was really only people from overseas got to make movies, because virtually no movies would be made in my country. But then I saw a film, one little South African film called El Lollipop. And I remember being about 10 or 11 when I saw it. And I remember sitting rigidly in my seat because I'd never seen people that sounded like us represented on screen. And it was the first time I thought, oh, wait a minute. Stories can be about anyone, anywhere. And we could tell stories like this. And maybe I could tell stories. And then I thought it would be much to think of because I was from a place far, far away from where films seem to be being made. Anyway, so the military thing was as a draft. I was drafted, you know, I got call-up papers when I was 15, 16 years old, drafted when I was 17, right out of high school. And then I spent those 2 years, got out of that, went to university, and my father felt that even though I was acting and had been acting and I was working and had an agent already, he really wanted me to have something, quote, as many fathers do, to fall back on.
Yeah.
So I did a law degree. And it was during that time that I also, again, you know, studying the law and policy issues and where does law come from and what kind of laws do we feel are just and unjust, especially at a time which was very intense in South Africa. You know, we would watch movies of Mandela and Desmond Tutu, like locked in rooms at the law school waiting for the security police to come bash the door down. And they would frequently raid campus and tear gas students and beat students. And so another opportunity to question authority, I guess.
Yeah.
So it seems strange, but I did the law degree for Dad. I worked only for 4.5 months, I confess, as a lawyer. I enjoyed the study of law because it's all about making an argument, and in a way, storytellers are making an argument. You're writing as a playwright or as a screenwriter or whatever in order to do two things, to entertain and then offer up something to talk about perhaps afterwards. But it was always, I was acting all the way through that. And then what happened is I worked as an actor for about 2.5 years in South Africa, and then I decided I really wanted to study film properly. I came to the United States, and I went to film school here at UCLA on their extension program at night school. And I kind of worked my way around during the day trying to get money to pay for that. And there we are.
Well, I just want everyone to know. I just want everyone to know. No, it's not as crazy as it sounds. It's actually less crazy that you went from the military to being this successful writer-director than it is. It's more crazy you went from starring in Kickboxer 5 to being a...
Yeah, oh, God, you see, you're going to dig it all out, aren't you? Okay, so Kickboxer, all right. Here's the thing. There were... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just busting your ball.
I have Kickboxer 5 and Delta Force 17 and those sort of things. Because after I finished law school and I was working as an actor, there was great theater work to do, and I'm proud of the theater work I did. But there was a company... run by a certain producer who's here in Hollywood today called Avi Lerner, who's a great guy.
That's right.
But Avi in those days was making really low-budget stuff in South Africa because it was really cheap to shoot there.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of us who could do a halfway decent American accent and only had a few lines that he needed because he'd bring out some, you know, soap opera actor to do some B-movie quickly and shoot it in 3 or 4 weeks and get footage that was outtakes from, you know, Hunt for Red October or something, and cut together some trailer. In those days when you clap stuff out on videos and people would rent it. And so I would get paid for a week's work on one of these horrible B-movies more than I'd get for a month in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
And then I realized, oh, my God, if I stay here doing this kind of, let's be honest, not great work, which is the only work that's available here, I'm wasting my time, and I better go back to law like my dad said.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm not ready to swallow my pride and go back to law. I better go to the States and start taking this career seriously. And so it was those B-movies, which are the only things being made in South Africa at that time, that almost propelled me. Well, to America, to try and take the craft more seriously.
Now that's a story I like. I love that story. That's great. Let me ask you about there's.
You want to dig up the window cleaning story too? Okay.
Now I'm curious about that too. There is some kind
of... One of the jobs I had was cleaning high-rise buildings as a window cleaner because it paid really well, and I was a rock climber for a while, and we used to clean these tall glass buildings.
Now, wait, where
and
did
that
you...
that paid really well, better than the theater or Avi Lerner's movie.
Now, anyway, wait, where did you do that at? Where did you do window cleaning?
In South Africa. There were these... Helmut Jahn is a great architect who built these amazing glass buildings, and he built a number of them in Johannesburg. But in those days, he didn't care a damn how you cleaned them. So these huge, spired kind of glass buildings with angled glass that you couldn't hang normal window cleaning equipment on. I saw a notice with a friend of mine in a climbing store one day. Said, any climbers can help us clean this particular building. Please give a call on this number. So we did, and from there we ended up with about 15 buildings that we cleaned while we were students and managed to save some money from that. So,
man, God bless that you're alive. I was going to say, the controversy surrounding this movie, I don't really think there's that much controversy, but I want to ask you about the changes, the changes that you guys made from the book to the screen, and also the other issue that's been coming up, the political one, which I don't think is as big of a deal as people are making out. But first of all, I want to ask, why did you decide to go with this age range for the children? Because in the book...
Well, as you know, the book, the young character in the book starts the book at 6 years old and he ends the story at 13. So it takes place over that period of about 7 or 8 years. The difficulty in a film is if you start a film with a six-year-old actor and then switch the actor on the audience to 8 and then switch one to 10, it's hard enough to find an actor that can cope with the emotional demands of this story anyway. And then to be switching them out on the audience was just not going to work. So we all agreed very early on that it had to be, we had to use one actor and that we would compress the time period over which the story took place to about 9 months to a year. And then you ask, well, which particular, so, you know, age range? Well, the most intense time for Ender Wiggin is that final year of his life when he has the major battle. I don't want to give anything away, but you know in the film. So let's focus the story there. And the way to deal with his early life, I thought, in the film was to put him in the opening scene into a military school. He's already recruited into a military school on Earth. And so we know he knows how to march, he knows how to salute, he's already in an authoritarian environment where he's being monitored, and we can then pretty soon get him up to battle school and then to Eros, where he fights the final game of battle, and focus on that more intense period of his life where he's a young boy on the verge of being a man. And so we ended up deciding that we would make him 12 going on 13.
That's very thought out and fair. Another question that I'm going to be hearing about a lot is, what made you guys decide to give... I don't want to spoil anything, but Ender, something happens to Ender in the film that doesn't ever happen in the book, where Ender loses a fight. Let's just put it that way. One of his many fights along the way actually loses. And what made you guys decide to add that into the film?
Well, if I'm don't feel afraid of it. Are you talking about when he's in the simulation battles Eros?
Yes. The mission failure.
Well, I think the point is that there were, in the book, he becomes increasingly exhausted and overwhelmed.
Right.
And it takes many, many, many battles. I mean, you could make a 15-hour mini-series out of this. And that's hard to do. So what we had to do is he wins certain battles, but there's also a moment when he becomes overwhelmed. And in fact, it is in the book. In the book, you know, one of the characters throws up. It's all getting too much. And so we come to a more of a montage battle where, being overwhelmed, he finally can't cope, and a lot of the ships crash into each other and things go to hell for a moment.
And
it's just a symptom of his overwhelmedness that you're trying to do cinematically, which in the books takes many chapters.
Right. And then I guess the final thing I was going to ask you about the film to the book is the battle room scenes. I think people are going to envision the battle room in a thousand different ways. You know, as a reader, if you listen to the audio book, if you read it and use your own mind, your own visuals, I think you're going to see it any way possible. In the book, they're brown. They're like brown little like sofa cushions where these kids can't get hurt on them or anything. I mean, these kids... the battle room scene, how did you envision this, and did you necessarily take it from the book, I guess is the best way
well,
to
again,
put it.
Great question. In the book, the principal notion behind the battle room is that it takes place in a black box, a large, very large black box. My difficulty with that off the bat was I'm going up into space with these kids. I'm in a battle school in space, and when I jump out into a simulated space flying environment, I'm in a black box. I might as well be on Earth. So although when I read the book, I can imagine these battles and it's all about the characters, you actually have to fully detail out exactly what you're going to see, and you go, black box. So I had this notion of putting it in a huge glass sphere that was, you know, as big as a football field in all directions. Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, I just heard some bleeping. So I had this notion of putting it in a huge glass sphere that's kind of as big as a football field in all directions, because it would do a couple of things. First of all, when you jump out into that space, you, as a kid jumping out into that space, you see Earth far below you. You see the sun somewhere out there. You see stars. You see the moon. You know, it gives you a greater feeling of being in space and flying in space than if the world were simply black. The other thing it does is it, because it's a big glass sphere, it affords me the opportunity to change the lighting conditions as they're changing around me in the world around me. So the first time he goes out in the battle room, it's a kind of mid-morning feeling, and the Earth is beautiful and blue below us, and that's our planet that's worth saving. You know, down there is this beautiful blue planet with water, which is what the aliens have really come for. And then the next time you're in there, you can put the sun behind Earth and eclipse it, and then the room is dark and moonlit, and the mood is completely different when he jumps out there with Petra. And in another battle, we just have the sun coming up over the Earth and shafting this warm light through the battle room, and it gives it a different mood again for the salamander battle. And then we eclipse it and take the moon away behind the Earth for the final battle, which makes it very sort of noirish and dark.
Yes.
So that each time you're in the battle room, you can change the mood through lighting because of the sphere that you've created. So a lot of what drove me in the battle room was I felt that this is such an iconic thing from the book, this magnificent battle room. How can I give it as much visual punch as possible in the movie and have it change through it so that we're not in the same environment each time we go into that battle room?
Well, I think that's a good answer. I've learned so much from you as a director, and I'm going to go make my first film, and my first film, which we're going to make this upcoming year.
Good for you, yep.
Yeah, I'm very excited, but it does deal with gay themes. And this film very much is about bullying to a degree and finding yourself,
yep.
Which I think is a universal theme. Of course, we know, for those that don't, Orson Scott Card's views on gay marriage are he's anti it. But I've spent a lot of time coping with this myself, especially in Hollywood, when you're dealing with people that necessarily don't share the same views as you, and sometimes even
yep.
worse in Hollywood, you're dealing with people that aren't really good people, but they do good business. How did you, for two things, I guess, how did you end up coping with that you have very different viewpoints than this man about those issues, and how would you tell the gay community that basically is afraid to go give this movie money,
yep.
that it's okay, and that there are great messages in here, and this is not against the gay community?
Well, firstly, let me say that I fully understand the folks who feel that they do not wish to give Orson Scott Card a penny.
Yeah.
It's a totally reasonable and understandable position to take. I have worked, my early work was in HIV/AIDS for the Department of Health in South Africa. I won a South African Emmy for my work in that field, and I have a completely different view to Orson Scott Card on issues of gay rights and gay marriage and so on, and that's I've been a member of Courage Campaign for many years, a great organization that has been very much pro-gay gay marriage in California, and I'm very proud of the work that they do. So Orson and I have very different views on the issue of gay marriage. So how do I cope with the book? It's an excellent question. I confess that when I first read the book, I had no idea who Orson Card was.
Yeah.
I read this book, and I thought, this is a great book. This has themes of compassion, tolerance, even love of the enemy. That's a huge theme, of the enemy.
Absolutely. The movie opens with that.
Well, I go in and I pitch this, and I'm perhaps naively, I'm not aware of this author. I come from a country where gay marriage has been legal since 2006, where constitutionally sexual orientation is constitutionally protected. And here I am in the United States of America, and it's not the same.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, this is a great book. It doesn't occur to me the author might have these strange views. But, of course, they come to me within a few months. And I come home to my wife, and I go, Riss, I can't believe what this guy's saying. I have to drop this project.
Yeah.
And we have a big conversation, and I look at this book, and I go, wait a minute, but I really am, given my military background and all these feelings, my authoritarian issues and all that, damn it, these themes are strong. This book is great. It's beloved by many, gay and straight alike.
Yeah.
Love this book.
Yes.
You go online, there's many gay people who love this book and are deeply distressed by Orson's views and are going through the same dilemma. I love this book. What do? Push it aside, never see his work again. It's a genuine, heartfelt, understandable dilemma we're all facing. My attitude came from something that my president, when in 1995, Nelson Mandela, did. There was a 1995 World Cup. Rugby was a game played largely by white conservative South Africans.
Yes.
It was their game. Black South Africans were more, and still are, more a fan of soccer, although many, many more are now playing rugby. And our teams are better for it. But in 1985, after the 1994 first democratic elections, the country was a new non-racial democracy, very new, very fragile. And we were going to play. And many people were saying, there's no way that the South African community can support this. We're not going to attend, da da da. And what did Mandela do? He appropriated the very most precious sport of those conservatives. He put on the Springbok rugby jersey. He stepped out onto the field. He shook the hands of every single player, and there was only one black player on that team at that point. He shook the hands of white players, many of whom had been and probably still were very racist in their outlook. And he appropriated that sport for the entire country. And 64,000 South Africans in Ellis Park Stadium, most of whom I assure you were white, stood up and chanted his name, and probably 63,000 were probably white. And they started chanting, Nelson, Nelson, and they adored him.
Yeah.
And he totally stripped that sport of its racist approach.
Yep.
Now, How do we apply this to Orson Scott Card's book? I love Orson Scott Card's book, and I'll be damned if Orson Scott Card's views, with which I strongly disagree, will cow me into saying I no longer love his book. I love this book. I appropriate his book and its messages of compassion and tolerance and respect for the other, all of which I actually think he feels, possibly because he's a Mormon and feels often like an outsider. Well, guess what? Other people feel like outsiders too. And the message of your book is inclusive, and I promote that message, and I disagree with you on your stance on gay marriage. And that's kind of what made me feel like we would do it. And I said to my wife, there's a day coming that this is potentially going to undermine the film. The day coming when one's going to have this conversation. To think otherwise would be naive. And on that day, and thank you for giving me this opportunity, and I've had it with other publications too, I'm going to say what I think. And even though the film has nothing to do with gay marriage and everything to do with understanding your enemy and tolerance and how to find your own moral compass, it's going to need to be said. And if it harms the film, so be it.
Yeah.
I believe that the message of this film is powerful and strong and about compassion. And perhaps Orson's views will evolve in his own time, just as Barack Obama's views have had to evolve on the issue.
That's right.
Just as Bill Clinton's views. Bill Clinton, who signed DOMA into law and now has the opposite view. So I really think it comes down to this. Art must be separated from the artist. But it's very, very hard to do at times. Richard Wagner wrote great music. He's an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Do Jewish conductors conduct his music? Some do and some won't. And it's very understandable. But for me, the book is a beautiful expression of compassion and tolerance. And that's what I want to promote.
Well, from one third...
Thanks for indulging me.
Yes. No. From one third to another, I just want to thank you very much for doing this, Gavin. I'd love to talk with you more sometime about, especially about some of your former films as well that I never have gotten the chance to talk with you about. You're a director I've learned a great deal from. You've taught me a lot going into my first film, and I really mean that. And I'm a big, big fan of yours, and I liked Ender's
Game. Very generous of you. Thank you.
Yeah, I liked Ender's Game, you gave the best, most heartfelt answer to that question ever, and I thank you for all the work you've done for the gay community, and I thank you for everything else you've done. You're a really good man. Thank you so, so much.
Well, it's life is tricky to navigate, right? But thank you for giving me the opportunity to explore where I'm coming from. I appreciate it very much indeed.
No, you're a good man, Gavin, and Friday,
right.
Ender's Game is out Friday, and thank you so much for doing the show. And
all right, that's Gavin Hood. Yeah, I just thought he was great. You do a lot of interviews with people, and some of these people I've never met before, and some I have, and Gavin's someone I hadn't met before. And I got to tell you, I did not know about his work history outside of film. I didn't know about his charitable works. And these are things they didn't talk about in that Advocate article, and I got to tell you, I think they missed a great opportunity to do some real journalism. But journalism's dying, which we are going to talk about in the next interview with Kevin MacDonald. And a big topic we talk about is the death of journalism, or is there going to be a resurgence, and what's happened with journalism? And so I think these two interviews tie together in that way. They also tie together because you have two outstanding award-winning directors. This next interview is with an Academy Award-winning director, Kevin MacDonald. And, I showered and did some apartment hunting during that interview. And I got to tell you, man, it is a renter's market in L.A. It is a renter's market in Chicago. It has always been a renter's market in New York. When you're a city where your people can't afford to buy homes, you're okay with that? You're fine with the fact that people can afford to live in your city for a couple years at a time before they're priced out and they have to go look for jobs somewhere else? I don't know, man. I find this, these apartment complexes are making mad money off of a bad market where people can't afford to buy homes. And they can't get loans from banks because banks are crying poor. And I don't know, man. It's man, it's screwed up. I'm not gonna go on a tangent about it, but I'm looking at this and I'm like, that's gonna be half my income a month to live here, half my income a month to live there. It didn't used to be that way. They used to say you want to spend about this was 10 years ago when I got my first apartment. They would say you wanted to spend 25% of your income on your apartment, and that's what I was paying for one bedroom in on Lakeshore Drive on the north side. I was paying for a one bedroom with 25% of my income. Now I'm sure that one bedroom's half my income. I bet it's half. So it's just crazy, man. I don't know. I'm not going to go off on it too much. Next interview is with Kevin McDonald. How I Live Now is the film. Saoirse Ronan is the star, and she's fantastic. This is a great interview, too. Kevin is European, and for whatever reason, I seem to really click with the Europeans. And if you're a filmmaker or you want to be in the business, this is also another really good interview to listen to. We talk about that quite a bit. We also talk about the state of politics in Britain and the UK. And we also talk about, you know, a lot of random things came up just because we felt like it. And I think it's a fascinating interview. And so here's Kevin McDonald. I'm going to go run to the store and get smokes. Enjoy. Okay, this is Matthew Aaron. I'm here with director Kevin McDonald. How I Live Now is the film. Comes out Friday. Theaters pretty much everywhere, and video on demand as well, iTunes, and Amazon, I believe, and all that kind of stuff, right? You don't
everywhere.
Know either.
I don't know. That's me. It's available anywhere and everywhere.
I love when I ask you that question. It's like Bill Nighy in Love Actually when they're talking about his record. And he's like, I don't know. Whatever. I don't know either. Video on demand. No, it's video on demand and it's in theaters on Friday. Help me out with, I've been trying to pronounce her name all day. Saoirse Rose?
Saoirse Ronan. I used to always have a lot of difficulty with her name.
Saoirse Ronan.
She said to me, just think inertia, Saoirse.
Saoirse Ronan. I like that. Okay. Because she was great in Hannah. And
she's great in everything she does. She's the best young actress there is out there. And
I would argue that you're correct on that. I would concur, actually. I wouldn't even argue it. I would concur. She's very good.
She's very, very good, and I think she's the Meryl Streep of her generation.
Wow, that's high praise. So when you set out to do this film, were you attached to it from the beginning?
No, I wasn't, actually. A friend
okay.
of mine, a producer, Charles Steele, who I've done a couple of movies with, had optioned the book and doing it with another director. And he sent me the book just to say, look, I'm doing this. It's a great book. You should read it.
Yeah.
And I read it. So original and beautiful the book, and I said to him, I love this. And so I expected. I don't read many young adult books, and
right.
this was really, really beautiful. And then a year or two later, he said to me, oh, you know, that other director's dropped off. We're looking for somebody else to do it. I know you liked the book. Were you interested? And I said, yeah. Let me see if we can find a way. And so it took a long time then, for even from that point, to get a script that we liked, because it was a very hard adaptation, actually.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. I felt the same way, that this had to be something very difficult to adapt. Saoirse, was she involved already at that point? She was already...
No, she wasn't at all. There was no cast attached. And, you know, we very early on, I wanted to make a movie that was on a very small scale.
Yeah.
And which could be financed purely out of Europe. And I didn't have the pressure of, you know, of a big budget and studio release and all that. So we were lucky enough to be in a position where we had the money in place. We had no expectations of any stars. And I just started looking for actors. And I came to America. I worked with the casting director here, met a lot of people, a lot of actors here in Hollywood,
yeah,
a lot of unknowns on the East Coast. And the casting director literally met thousands of girls. I couldn't find anybody I felt was. And so I almost gave up. And then somebody said, well, you know, you sent it to Saoirse. I had it in my head I wanted an unknown.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, she's Irish. She's not American. And she came to see me, and she read two scenes, and I was just immediately blown away and thought, why have you been such an idiot? Why didn't you send it to her to begin with? She's so fantastic. So then suddenly the movie was happening because you know,
sometimes we convince ourselves as filmmakers. And by the way, for people that don't know, you're just as good as a documentary filmmaker as you are a fictional filmmaker or original narrative. But sometimes we box ourselves into these ideas of what we want, and sometimes we don't think about outside the box.
That's so right. And then you think you want something, and you're so determined that this is right, and then something else is just pushed in front of your face, and you're saying, oh, why did I rule this out to begin with?
Yeah.
And often with casting, that is the case for me anyway, that I think I want something. And the same with when I did Last King of Scotland with Forest Whitaker. I honestly thought, that was no way Forrest Whitaker was going to be right, but the casting director had called him and left him.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I should see him.
Yeah, it's Forrest Whitaker. You might as well meet with him.
He might as well meet with him. He comes in, I'm thinking, he doesn't look right, he's too sweet, he's too gentle, you know, and then he reads the scene, and I'm like, oh my God, how did I, why was I so narrow-minded?
I think that's
just one of those things that's really lovely about making films, actually, is that you can't be unless you're making an animation, you're not totally in control, and therefore, actually, you need to allow, you know, chance to play its part.
For me, at least, because I'm making my first film this winter, and I'm going through the same thing you... Oh, thank you. I'm going through the same thing you went through with this, where I've seen, like, 100 guys for this one role, and it's just nothing. They're good at certain things, or some aren't right at all, but it's like all the components aren't coming together, and my friends in the business, a lot of big directors are like, you know, I know this person's a name and you want an unknown, but consider sending it to so-and-so. And I'm like, I'll never do it, it's low budget, it's this and that, and you'd be surprised. And I think the other thing is, as directors, sometimes because we're in the business and we're in this bubble, we know these people personally, or we know personal stories about them. We know what kind of person they are, and we forget that they can act as something else. And I think in the case of Forrest Whitaker, maybe you know his reputation. You're like, he's too nice of a guy.
I think that's really true. I mean, recently I had the same thing on the movie I've just finished shooting on Friday, which is called Black Sea with Jude Law in it. And Jude Law's playing a blue-collar submariner. You know,
yeah.
Who works in a submarine. You would never think of Jude Law for that.
No.
You wouldn't. You see, and it's kind of, but then he read the script. He liked it. We met. I thought, there's no way Jude Law's going to write this. We discussed it. He understood the character. He read a couple of scenes for me, and I was like, my God, he's perfect. And he's done it. He's completely, you know, transformed himself to do something that you would never have expected of him. So I think, you know, actors act. They change themselves if they're good actors, and that's, you know, a lesson I go on learning.
Well, what I think's fascinating about you, and this is in your documentaries as well, is you are truly interested in three-dimensional people. And I'll give you a great example. With State of Play, I don't think anyone would have said Russell Crowe. I just don't think off the top of my head, newspaper reporter, Russell Crowe, hardcore journalist, or Jason Bateman in the film, or Ben Affleck as kind of a sleazy, philandering congressman. Those are not ideal, like, pop in your head. That's not who they've played in the past. That's not who the business knows them as. So I think you're really good, and it seems like, maybe you're being humble, but it seems like you kind of, sometimes even with Forrest Whitaker and with Saoirse, you all kind of ask backwards in the... into having them, but I find that fascinating about your films is you do end up casting a lot outside the box.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
Now you've got Jude Law in a submarine.
Yeah, no, I do, because actually there's something, I think you can never find the person in your head, and that's what it is. And then you start to see, when you meet people and you think, oh, there's an aspect to them which is I've never seen before, and I'm sensing this aspect of them. And I can see they can understand this character that's in the script in a way that's different than how it was maybe written. But actually, it makes it more interesting than what it was how it was written. Because if you go with the obvious thing, then that's how you get cliche, isn't it? It's when you go when you give something a little twist and you put someone in the part who, you know, doesn't superficially appear to be correct, that you get something, hopefully, something magical going on.
Right, and I think a guy like Jude Law, too, for this film. Mm-hmm. I think they bring not saying anything bad about those other actors who end up doing the same roles, like a Hugh Grant, because Hugh Grant's been fantastic in other things where he doesn't play Hugh Grant. But they bring a different complexion to the character, a different side that you wouldn't see.
They make them more three-dimensional.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. They make them feel more real because they're playing against type. They're not playing just a superficial version of who that character is.
So when you're making this film, because it's adapted from a book, How I Live Now, and the book came out, I think, 2005, 2006?
Sorry, a little before that, I think 2003, 2004.
Okay,
so
okay.
That, yeah.
For those who don't know, the film is about a girl who gets sent to England for, like, you know, pretty much like a vacation, and she's hanging out with her step-cousins, which is kind of a racy thing here, and she falls in love with her older step-cousin, and then a nuclear war breaks out, and it's World War III in England. And
in the countryside.
Right, which is crazy. And they get separated, and I thought going into this, okay, this is going to be a war movie. And the war is kind of a backdrop, and it's subtext. And in the book, it's a little more, but it's a book. So when you guys chose to adapt this novel, what made you guys go, listen, we are going to focus on the love story and let the war be the subtext?
Because I think that movies aren't very good being about more than one thing. And that you know, what a movie is about thematically, you can put in two paragraphs usually. And if you can't, it's probably a bad thing.
Yeah.
And so we struggled for a long time trying to find, although it's a, you know, it's a slim book, I don't know how long it is, 250, 300 pages, it's not a big book, and it's a young adult book, and you wouldn't have thought it was that complex. But there's a lot going on in it, and it's also told in the first person, which makes it very difficult to adapt, because one of the things that's beautiful about the book is the voice of the main character of Daisy, and you can't really have that in cinema unless you have a narration all the way through, which isn't very cinematic. And so finding how to portray a character and finding what the central drive of the book, of the film should be thematically, that was the hard thing. And I always just felt like it's a love story. It is a bit like Jude Law's film called Manton. It's about somebody falling in love, and then that love gives them the strength to survive the most terrible events that happen.
That's kind of a fascinating comparison to Cold Mountain. I didn't think of that. Yeah, that's a very similar themed film. And, you know, I thought there, and before I watched this too, because I've told you I'm a big fan of your work. So one of your motifs usually is anti-authority figures, okay? And in this film, there's not really that so much. Mm. I mean, if you went with the war angle, it probably would have been, but you didn't. So what drew you to just doing a romance? Because for me, this was different than all your other work.
Well, I don't see it as just a romance, because I see it as about a really complex and interesting character, somebody who's this girl who is really unhappy and miserable because she's not loved.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know how to love anybody else, so she's not loved. And also her head is filled with all of this nonsense that she's told by society around her, what she reads in women's magazines, what her friends tell her. She's got all this sort of rules and regulations on what she should eat and shouldn't eat, and things going on inside her head, like I think a lot of teenagers do. And she's got to find a way through, as the war is going on, as her life is in danger, as people around her are being killed, she's got to find a way to learn how to love.
Yeah.
And that to me was what was most interesting, was how out of the most horrible circumstances can somebody be transformed personally and actually find themselves and become happier in a weird way while horror is going on around them. And I think one of the inspirations for the book, I think, and certainly for the film for me, was, you know, what happened in Britain during the war. There was a lot of kids who were sent away to the countryside to avoid the bombing in London and that kind of thing, and how those kids had transformative experience, their lives were changed. There were city kids who went to the countryside for the first time, whose eyes were opened, and who strangely had wonderful magical times while the world was collapsing around them. And that to me was a really interesting paradox.
Yeah, because you find a way to adapt, or you're forced to adapt, you know.
Yeah, and the happiest moments in this film are just after a nuclear bomb
right.
went off, and the kids are on their own with no adult supervision, having a great time, breaking taboos,
yeah.
Getting back to nature in a way, and so that's going on while the world is collapsing around them, and that to me was fascinating.
Well, I find that fascinating too, because here's the parable I see with this. And I mean, like I said, you're a very humble guy, but the way I look at this is, it is definitely also a criticism on. Let's face it, it's an American girl that goes to England, and it's a different kind of love than, I don't know, I find this, because I've dated Europeans, I find that the way they see love is kind of more of the way you're told you're supposed to see love. And in America, I feel that's very broken right now. And you brought that up with the women's magazines and the way everyone talks and with the dating apps and with the Craigslist and how you meet people and treat yourself nowadays. I think we value it less in America than Europeans do. And I think this movie kind of says that in a way, because it, there's,
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's certainly not deliberately there. I think some of those things exist in the UK and in Europe as well. I think what is maybe different culturally
yeah.
is that, you know, what, that these guys are step cousins and they fall in love there. In the book, it's kind of, you know, made, it was still a best-selling book in Europe
yeah.
and I did pretty well here, but. To a lot of people, that's kind of a taboo, which is, ooh, that's going over the edge
yeah.
a little bit. That makes me feel uncomfortable. But I think in a European context, that's sort of a bit exciting.
Yeah, right.
The breaking the baking of taboos. When you're a teenager, you haven't set up those sort of social norms yet about what, you know, you should behave like this and you shouldn't behave like that. And, you know, I would gladly tell you I fancied my cousin. You know, I liked my cousin. I didn't think about it, but. I had a very attractive cousin.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's what fiction is for, is to explore things that maybe you wouldn't really do in real life, but that actually are, you know, part of us. And so also I thought there was something about that aspect of two people who are cousins, even though they're step-cousins, but they're falling in love, which goes into the central theme of the movie in a way, which is about family and about not having a family and creating
yeah.
a family and becoming a family and... and I thought that was interesting. Also, it makes it not just your average teen love story.
No, that's true. It is different than any teen film you're going to see, that's for sure. Especially young adult romances, you're not going to see anything quite like this, which is, and it's fascinating. What I was going to ask you about too then is, you know, so for me as an American, I watched this and that's how I criticized it. That's how I saw it. But that's the great thing about film. I'll see something, someone else will see something. It's all based off personal experiences and what you see. Now, I think it's pretty clear, though, with your film State of Play, you're definitely criticizing the death of journalism. Which, by the way, not only here, I think in Britain and where it was originally written, of course, with the Murdoch problems there and the wiretapping and the, I mean...
Well, it's very interesting because when I made that movie, which is now 4 or 5 years ago,
yeah.
something like that, things were more dire than they are now. I think there's a little more hope out there, actually, for journalists.
You do?
I think there is. I mean, there's a number of correspondents, and particularly foreign correspondents, collapsing all the time. Newspapers have less and less money, and therefore can spend less and less time on stories and less time on investigations. That is all true. That's all still going on. Newspapers are closing all the time. But... the internet has taken over from just being a place where bloggers write their opinions about things.
Yeah.
To be a place where actually journalism does happen. And I think that what's going on with Amazon, with Jeff Bezos
sure.
buying the Washington Post, it's a really interesting sign. I think that he's a clever guy. He's going to try and make that work. He's going to try and find a way to make news pay.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe... journalism is turning the corner, and I think that, you know, it's going to be different than it was in its heyday in the all the President's Men era, and we could all be nostalgic about that, but that actually I'm a little more optimistic than I was.
That's good. I could see that. I mean, I guess the two problems I'm having with journalism nowadays is, one, the paparazzi is not regulated at all. And my argument with that is, I know everyone says free speech, but we regulate TV, we regulate films, we regulate CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. So why isn't the paparazzi regulated? That bothers me a lot. And then the other thing that I think really bothers me and that I love about State of Play is because you guys don't specifically talk about this, but, well, in a way you do. The powerful figures that run these countries nowadays, they're, people are scared to do investigative journalism on them. I mean, even it shocks me knowing what I know about people even in Hollywood that nothing's ever written about them because there's some bad people everywhere, everywhere.
Well, I think look, that's the great importance of journalism, which is that journalism is meant to, you know, tell the truth to power. And the great thing about investigative journalism is that they're meant to find out, investigative journalism is meant to find out all those bad things that are going on and hold people accountable. And it's a crucial, crucial part of our democracy, and that's why it always amazes me that people aren't more concerned about what But I do think that, you know, it's always been the case that that journalism has never been perfect. They've never picked up on a lot of stories they should have picked up on. They've been, people have been bribed. People have been imperfect. And journalists aren't perfect. Certainly in State of Play, they're not perfect. And it's going on at the moment, all the wiretapping scandals in the UK at the moment, in the Murdoch Empire, they're not perfect. Although you could say that actually stepping over the line in pursuit of a story, maybe that's a good thing we should celebrate.
So, I mean, I think so.
I think there's an ambivalence about my feeling about
But it took a long time for that to happen, though, for them to step over the line and chase that story. There was a long time where the military police didn't do anything, the MPs didn't do anything. Yeah. Like, it was a long time before someone stepped up and started investigating it.
Yeah.
It was the murder of that girl, wasn't
Millie,
it?
Millie Dowler,
yeah.
But I think that, you know, what WikiLeaks and Snowden at the moment, I mean, I think that, again, that's a kind of, I think it's a great sign. I mean, you can agree with what they're doing or not agree with what they're doing, the individual cases, but actually they're fulfilling the same function that the way investigative journalism was. They're exposing things to public scrutiny that otherwise would not be put into public scrutiny. So again, that's a way in which the internet, which was the great threat to journalism, is actually helping.
The only thing that bothers me, especially in this industry, is the reason I have my own show and we do it separate from everywhere else and we didn't team up with another website or whatever is because I go to these screenings sometimes. I go to these press days sometimes. The studios fly in people, pay people off, like, and they're totally cool with it. Like, not the studios. I'm talking about the bloggers and the so-called journalists. And it bothers me that they can put that title on their resume, journalist, when they're going to go see, what was this weekend? They flew in tons of people for Thor 2. And you know what's going to happen. None of those people are going to give it a bad review. None of those people are going to say anything they shouldn't say. They're getting a comp trip out of it.
Because they want to get the next one.
Yeah. So, I mean, that stuff bothers me. And
well, as it should. I think that should. I think that, you know, the journalism and journalists remain as pure as possible and detached from the powers that be. Now, obviously, entertainment journalism, it's not so serious.
No.
I mean, you know, for me it's serious.
Right,
for you,
me too,
serious,
right.
But in the scheme of things, it's not so serious.
No, but the connection to that I was going to make is, and the reason, another reason why I love this film is you guys got the financing independently. It pretty much is an independent film.
Yeah, no, it's a totally independent film. And, that was one of the providers for doing it. I said, I want to make this for as cheap a amount of money as we can make the movie. And I want it to be independent of anyone telling me, oh, no, you can't do this,
right,
you can't do that, that's not acceptable. And just, I wanted just to make the movie that I wanted to make. And that was a really, you know, great experience, actually.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk about that, but my point being is with the death of journalism, and yes, I hope it is getting better, but especially in the entertainment industry, this has been one of the best years for film I've seen in a long time.
It does seem to be.
But it's funny. You and I know that. I don't know if the general public knows that, because the general public didn't necessarily see Before Midnight, Short Term 12, Spectacular Now, all these great films that came out, documentaries like Spinning Plates. People didn't see these films because I feel like the bloggers and all these people, they're not talking about them. The part of the reason we had that big independent movement back in 96, 97, and even a little before that was everybody was focusing on, this is where the great films are. Now we're focused on what's a new superhero movie. What's it? And those movies are already going to make a ton of money anyways, and they're not everlasting. Those Iron Man is not going to be Iron Man in 30 years. They're going to remake it. It's no kid's going to watch that in 30 years. I still watch Chinatown to this day. And I feel like those movies aren't getting enough press. And that's why I'm really proud to see this film.
One of these things that's happening is that in my opinion, in the media, is that we are concentrating more and more and more on fewer and fewer books, films, plays, whatever it is. And it's the end result of kind of blockbusterdom. But actually, you end up with only 10 movies a year that the press talk about, because somehow it's a self-fulfilling prophecy the bigger things are, the more money that's spent on them, the more they have to make money. And you would think that the internet, everything would lead you to believe that the internet was about broadening horizons and making it possible for people to see wider and wider things and to therefore make lots of different audiences who appreciate lots of different things. But weirdly, bizarrely, counterintuitively, the opposite has happened.
Yep.
And why that is, I don't understand.
I can't figure it out. I mean, I guess what it comes down to is if I run a website.
It's because we're overwhelmed with choice.
Right.
The internet is about too much choice. And therefore, you want people to tell you, definitively go see this, go see that, and that's and keep it.
And
simple.
There's so much competition, everything's about money, that if I run a JoeBlow.com or an Ain't It Cool News and I'm Harry Knowles or I'm Burge, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, okay, all these websites are coming up. We're not getting as many hits this month as we got last month. We need to really pile on with the superhero stuff or the sci-fi crap or whatever people are really into at the moment. Just pile it on with all the updates we can, and let's focus on that. And, of course, those fan bases are hardcore fan bases as well, which is huge. What I find interesting about your filmmaking is, and just to change the topic here for a moment, I feel like you would be a really great television guy, too. Does that interest you at all with all these directors going to TV, all these film directors?
Absolutely. I think, like a lot of people, I've talked about doing some TV.
Yeah.
I haven't actually done any yet, and I'm developing a couple of different TV things.
Okay.
I think what I find difficult about TV is that I find the long-running series really difficult to understand. And that's just because I think in terms of a story.
So you like a 13-episode miniseries,
sort of
or the way they do it in the BBC with six,
I can get my head around.
Right, like the original State of Play.
Yeah, exactly. Those sorts of things I think are great, and I understand. It's like it's a one story which is told over in great detail over, whatever it is, 12 weeks, 6 weeks, 15 weeks. It's when you get into the idea of, okay, you're going to do 22 episodes this
season
year, and then you're
going to
do 22, and you're going to do I kind of like, that loses me. But
what about cable? What about something like Breaking Bad, where they did 13 episodes a year? Is that something you think
I love
that you could see?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think television is all about great writing.
Yeah.
And so if I had a great piece of writing, if somebody came to me, I would leap at the chance to do it. I definitely would leap at the chance to do it. And I think one of the great things that's happened in the last few years is as independent movies have maybe their audiences have gone down, obviously TV has taken that place, and the quality of TV now is so incredible it equals or surpasses a lot of movies.
Well, it's fascinating you bring that up, because this movie that you just did, I'm sure it'll do fine in theaters, but it's going to do really well on video on demand because it's TV. But as a filmmaker, does that bother you that it's now going directly to TV, where you're like, I don't want people to watch this on the television at home?
Well,
or are you like, I just don't care as long as they watch it?
No, I don't feel that.
Okay.
I feel that, but I feel really personally ambivalent about it because, I spend a lot of time making it look good and making the sound huge and elegant of it and making it a cinematic experience. But I also know from my own life, I've got three young kids. There's a lot of movies that come out that I want to see, and yet I can't get out. I can't pay a babysitter every time. I can't persuade my tired wife to come out. So actually, I will sit and watch something at home on VOD and really enjoy it. And I think it's never as good, and I hope it doesn't lead to the death of the cinema space, but it's better than not seeing it at all.
I don't think it'll ever lead to the death of... I know people are arguing that it's going to lead to the death of cinema. I think that's ridiculous. People are still going to go to the movies. You see it every week.
I think independent
cinema
is where it's really, really problematic. I think if you're making a big, big blockbuster and it's a really property Iron Man or whatever it is. People will go to Superman. They want to see it in that company. They want to see it with their friends.
It's an event.
A good time event sort of thing. Yeah. I think it is. It is with smaller, more delicate films. I think it's a tough one.
I could see like a Before Midnight here, which I think is one of the best films of the year. It's like I could see that going directly to video on demand, and that like pains me. It really hurts.
Yeah, well, it's sad because it's seen the death of an art form in a way.
Yeah, yeah. So that being said, you did an independent film. Studio free, no notes, no crazy notes, no nobody breathing down your neck, no one telling you who you got to cast and not cast. Okay, freeing experience, yet now you're going to have a release. You're not going to be in 3,500 theaters. You're in a lot of theaters that people can see this Friday, but not 3,500, and you're going to video on demand as well. What are the – would you do independent again, though? It sounds like you had a great experience.
I definitely would. I mean, I think that this movie could be made cheaply enough that I could do it like that. Obviously, sometimes it depends what the subject matter is.
Yeah.
The movie I've just completed, shooting, I haven't even started editing it yet, called Black Sea. It's a submarine thriller. It's a focus film.
Sure.
The old focus is sort of disappearing a little bit now. It's a universal film, so it's a kind of, studio independent kind of movie. So it will be more, the traditional theatrical route and all of that. But, in a way, the difference between doing that and doing an independent movie is not that great, except that the risks that they're gonna interfere.
Yeah.
So, obviously, the great thing about doing something with a studio is that, if they like the movie, they get behind it, and it can be seen by lots and lots of people. I think it's much harder in the independent sphere to break out because the amount of money they're spending on promotion are much more small. Fortunately, promotion is, 9/10 of the rule.
What are the pros and cons of taking more money or less money when you're doing an independent film to a studio film?
What do you mean, personally taking less money? Or
not personally. I'm talking about – I'm assuming you're just a billionaire.
Assume away.
No, I'm talking about with the film budget. When you're offered a movie – because I got to assume after all your success – and by the way, great documentarian too with Touching the Void and Marley and like – okay. So – and you have a new film coming out at Christmas. What's it called?
Christmas Day.
Christmas in a Day?
I did a film called Life in a Day a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Which was like – weird YouTube experiment and lots of video clips, amateur bits of video, all shot on a single day, I put them together into a movie experience, into a kind of collage.
So this one's life, Christmas.
This is Christmas last year, but it's much smaller film. It's only Britain.
Okay,
it's just in Britain.
So my question then is, I got to imagine with all your success, you've been offered pretty big budget films.
Yeah.
I got to also imagine you've turned them down because I've seen what your work's been.
Yeah.
Why? And what is the difference for you with a big-budget film and a lower-budget film? What are the pros and cons?
Well, I think they're kind of obvious. I have been in the past offered lots of big-budget movies, and I think, it's not that I'm not wanting to do those movies.
Sure.
It's fun to work with a lot of money, and it's fun to be paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
But actually, if you read the script and you think, I just don't understand this. I don't know. I wouldn't know what to do. And that's usually what I think. I read it. I wouldn't know how to do this. I wouldn't know what to do. And unless the script connects with you in some personal way, it's very hard. It's very hard to make a film. I think it's a hard process anyway. In the best of times, and I'm not a kind of. I think directors. I admire directors who can just switch from style to style and
Kenneth Branagh
and do that I'm not that kind of craftsman kind of person.
Yeah.
I could do that, and for me it's all about the script and what's about, and if it's about something that I really connect to and I'm interested in, then I will make it, and it's so the money kind of doesn't usually come into it, to be honest.
So that's something you don't basically for you first things first is the story.
First things first, the story, what it's about, and do I understand it? Do I understand the characters? And I think the truth is that certainly the bigger budget films are about spectacle, and they're about characters who don't quite make sense a lot of the time because they go at the service of a story. And I just I, just get lost in that stuff. I don't understand how you get in a way to make it convincing and to make it fun and entertaining.
Robert Duvall made two movies as a director. He made The Apostle, which is amazing, and Angelo, My Love, which is amazing. Okay. Both those movies, it took him years to do, and he pretty much financed them himself. Have you ever ran into a situation where you love the writing so much, even if it's a documentary, where we'll call it writing, but you love what it's about so much that you would have done anything to make that film? Have you had that experience?
I think when I made Touching the Void, which is a few years ago now, I had that was that experience for me. I just thought the story and the characters were so extraordinary that I would have made it by hook or by crook. But I think often in my life, working in the kind of, the fringes between independent and studio cinema or whatever, I will get to a stage where I say, I'll just pay for this myself. I want to have that shot. It comes to me. It becomes more important to me to make something. That's why, it's a bad thing to be, really. But I get more, once you reach a certain stage, you spend a year working on something, you're just thinking about that film, that object. That becomes your focus. It's not a professional. It's not like, by that sense, I think, I better keep all my fee. I would think, I'd rather spend some of my fee, need something to live on, but I'd rather some of it to get it to be how it to be. So, often that happens.
And what was the toughest film to get made?
The toughest
was film, it one of your documentaries, or was it,
well,
was it a
you know
narrative?
What? I think I have the belief that actually if you're satisfied with a script and a story and you think it's good, then you'll be able to persuade other people to finance it and make it good. And I've never been in a position where I've wanted to make something and then not been able to find the money.
That's great. Knock on wood.
But, of course, that's a lot of these things they're making in documentaries where it's very legit. And I think, there will come a time when that will not be the case. But up to this point, I've been very lucky, and I do have this belief that, if you have something good, money will come. Maybe not as much as you'd like. It's never as much as you'd like.
It seems like you're always working, though. I mean, it seems like you're always working.
Yeah, I enjoy working, and I enjoy...
Your whole family's in the business, right?
Your
wife is a production designer, am I correct?
Yeah.
And your brother owns one of the best companies in England, DNA, right?
And my grandfather was a famous writer in the British film industry, and...
So that's just something you guys are all comfortable with. You're finding.
Yeah, we've all sort of ended up in it, and we could make a movie, just in the family, not a football team, but a crew, an entire film crew. I think that we're all. As a family, we'd all go bankrupt if nobody made any more movies anymore.
Do you take a script like How I Live Now? Do you take a script like this and bring it to your wife or bring it to your brother or bring it to friends in the business? Or do you just read it and you know you want to do it and you don't need to talk to anyone else about it?
I do show it to other people, but I don't really listen to what they say. Because they say to me, why would you want to make that? And I say, I really want to make that. Why are you talking about it? So I sort of, the things I want to make, I really know I want to make them, but now I know how to make them right. Because often you think, I really want to make this. I know it can be great, but I don't quite know how to, this doesn't work about it. That doesn't work about it. How do you make that work? Then I will give it to friends and family, whatever, and get them to read it and say, what do you think? How would I do this? What's wrong with this? Why doesn't that work? And get the help of as many people as possible.
Yeah. Let me ask you, when you're doing a film, if it's a documentary or a studio picture, and if, for instance, I know the documentary you're putting out now, that's a Scott-Free production.
Yeah.
What does that add for you to have an executive producer like Ridley Scott on a production? Because does that actually take it out of your pocket because it's no longer your film and Ridley doesn't really do much and they just put it out? I mean, what are the pros and cons of working with an executive producer of that nature?
Well, the pros are that everybody knows who Ridley Scott is. And that opens a lot of doors, and I think that the pros outweigh the cons. The cons are only, I suppose, that if you're doing something as independently yourself, theoretically you'll make all the money.
It's your profit.
but actually, there's probably less money to spend. There's probably less money to make if you don't have someone like that on it. And also, you know, I'm not, I'm the one thing I'm really not interested in is running a production company, being in business.
Sure.
I don't have that kind of brain.
Do you see your
hopeless.
Brother doing it and you're like,
yeah.
I don't know how the fuck you do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't know how to do it. I mean, I'm hopeless at all that stuff. So I think I'd much rather be involved. I used to, years ago when I started off being going to have my own company, and you know, I was always having Max mad giving me letters saying, why haven't you paid this? And I, you know, I just wasn't good at running things. And so actually I'd be much happier just to have, you know, somebody else.
So that works out really well.
That works out.
Get a little back end, pay up front, and we're all good.
Yeah, exactly.
So let me ask you something about this film. We talked about Saoirse, but what about the character of Edward in the film? How did you come about casting him?
So that was very difficult because originally, as I'm saying, I was searching throughout America to find somebody to play Daisy. And so when you cast lovers, you need to have
chemistry.
Exactly.
How did you find that too? That's
so,
it's
so it's
two-parter.
Really, it's not just about finding one person; it's about finding two people. Well, I once I'd cast Saoirse, I then met loads of boys in the UK. It needed to be somebody British, and a lot of the people I'd met earlier when I was looking at an unknown, you know, I'd just missed from my head, including George Mackay, who's the guy who got the part in the end. I'd seen him and dismissed him, thinking he's not right, because I had in my head a different idea of who the girl was going to be. And then I looked back through what the casting director said, go back through some of those old people, you know, that we saw.
Yeah.
And there he was. I thought, he's interesting, and brought him in. And there was like half a dozen people I read with Saoirse. She came in and read with them. And it was kind of obvious who you know, who did she have a little chemistry with? Click with as an actor, who did she have a laugh with?
Yeah, the chemistry thing drives me wild. It's so funny how that works, because doing that right now, it's like, and my situation is really weird because it's a film about a straight man and a gay man who have like a friendship that evolves. So I have to have chemistry with a gay man, and like it's weird. It's weird because I think what people realize at home that we try to cover up as being all acting is there has to be a legitimate spark to make it easier to...
Oh, there totally does need to be. But you need to be able to imagine that these two would wind up in the sect.
Right.
So actually, it is possible. But also, you need to be able to imagine that they just get on. And that you can tell that people, you know, are comfortable with each other. They're genuinely smiling. They're laughing. Whatever. They're improvising a little off each other as actors. And I think that's it's one of those things that, you know, if it ain't there, it's nothing you can do about it.
As a director, does the height difference throw off anything for you? Is that, like, bothersome at all? Because I know there's a lot of directors that are like, you know, if you're doing a Tom Cruise movie, unless you get an Apple box, he's got to be casted with someone that's, like, 5'3", okay?
I think there is truth to that. But on the other hand, you know...
Because George is taller than Saoirse.
Yeah, but that's the norm, isn't
it? A little considerably. Yeah, it's norm. But I'm talking technically as a filmmaker, when you're framing and stuff,
framing
is a problem.
Obviously, if there was a freakish height difference, then yes,
sure,
it would bother me.
Sure.
But the height difference between them, you know, it didn't bother me. And in fact, I think that one of the things about George is he's, for a teenage boy, he's not teenage boy, he's 20 now, I think, but he's 20, 21.
Oh, he's young.
At the time he was 19, I think.
Wow.
He was masculine. He felt grown up, and part of that was, you know, in his height and his bulk in a way. And so, I didn't want a boy.
Yeah, right.
I didn't want him to be a boy, but I wanted him to feel young enough. And so, the height in that way was a good thing. I mean, look, I think it's different if you're doing a Tom Cruise movie. I mean, he's quite small.
Yeah. No, a lot of actors are short, though, out here. A lot. I knew that when I moved out here. I knew it, like, to a degree. And then you start meeting them all, and you read on the internet, oh, Al Pacino's 5'7". So he says. You know? And I always found that really fascinating. I also found it fascinating that a lot of European actors, famous European actors, seem to be taller.
Well, it is an odd thing, isn't it? I often find it with people... Somehow seeing people on the screen there's no way you can judge whether they're big or small.
Yeah, right.
And some actors you meet and they are like 6'6" And you're like, wow, I didn't realize you were so big.
Yeah.
And then there are other actors who are 5 foot three.
and
you're like,
realize
I didn't realize you were so minuscule. And because the camera just, you know, the camera is very forgiving.
I think the two people from Britain who I had no idea where they are, well, not one of them's not from Britain, but was Liam Neeson, like, and he's a huge guy, and Colin Firth. And I knew Colin was a tall guy because you could tell in his movies, but, I mean, I didn't know how tall that guy is. So, that's an example of that. And then, I totally see that. How I live now is, once again, theater's Friday. Video on demand, you can catch it on iTunes as well. Saoirse's great. I mean,
to Tom Holland, who you haven't mentioned.
Tom Holland
in
it,
The Impossible.
Yes.
He was Stolt film, The Impossible. He was the best thing.
How much
did
you like The Impossible? Did you like it?
I really liked him in it.
You liked Tom a lot.
I really liked the sort of first half. I thought the story, the problem is, it's the sort of story what you've, once you know that the family are alive, you're just delaying inevitable.
Yeah, that's true. That's kind of true.
But
Tom,
I thought it was
Tom
great in filmmaking. It was extraordinary. Great filmmaking.
You know, and that's the thing. When you're casting Saoirse and George, and George doesn't have a lot of work to go off of, right? So, and you probably didn't see any of it. I mean, I'm sure he knows. I'm sure you're not, like, bullshitting him about it. Mm. So it was basically in that casting session where you're like, he's the guy.
Yes.
How did you know he had the acting chops?
Because I read him on his own once before.
So you're, he's good, or he's great, or he's good enough to go to the
I think that I think he just felt like he was enough. Yeah, yeah. He felt like this guy's got something, and not just as an actor, but as, you know, as a soul, as a personality. I could feel, you know, you can feel who's got it.
Yeah,
and I think often for me that's what you're looking for in an actor, someone with this more than just what meets the eye on the surface. You know?
That's right. I think that's great. Well, you did a fantastic job with the film.
Thank you very much. It's been very nice talking to you.
It's been great talking to you, too. And also, your film with Jude Law, Black Sea.
Yeah.
And that comes out next year.
So this time next year, please.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, we'll talk then.
I hope so.
Once again, I want to tell you, while all my listeners are listening to this, Touching the Void, you have to see if you've never seen it. I mean, these are like filmmaking staples. You've made movies. I mean, you're a humble guy, but you've made movies that are for the aughts, from 2000 on, are filmmaking staples. If you love documentary, Touching the Void and Marley, you cannot do any better. And they're both so diverse in the style they're made in that you need to see these films. And also, of course, Last King of Scotland was great. But I love State of Play. I think the message is on point. I think it's – and by the way, I think – I don't know if the studio made you do this or whatever, but I think it ended up working where it's also a thriller at the same time. And it's really tense. And it's Russell Crowe's best work in a while. Of course, his film How I Live Now, which I think is fantastic. And it's one of the smarter young adult films as well. Don't let that scare you. It doesn't mean it's a talkie, you know, but it's not, you know, Twilight.
Yeah, it's definitely not
depth.
Twilight. That we can say.
Yeah, there's more depth to this is what I'm trying to say. And why I encourage you not to be scared of the word smarter is the depth of this film makes it so romantic. That whatever you thought was romantic in Twilight, you'll realize that was just about the superficiality of the good-looking men in the movie. And this is more about what love really is. And it's funny, this is a movie about discovery. This is a movie about a girl not only discovering herself, but you really see in the moment how she discovers love, which I think is fascinating. I think a lot of romance movies, all the characters before have always been in love, and they're hurt, and they're broken. This girl's never been loved, and you're actually seeing what it's like in the moment for brand new, this concept of love to come into her life. So I think that's fascinating. Kevin MacDonald, I Live Now is the film. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was fun.
All right.
Oh, my God. Wrap up, you blowhard. Jesus. Holy shit. That guy talks a lot, that Matthew Aaron. I got blueberry crumb cake in the oven. I'm going to probably make some turkey sausage and eggs for dinner. I'm going to do breakfast for dinner, I think. Protein. Going to go to the gym. This has been a good day. This has been a good show. Kevin MacDonald, How I Live Now is the film. It's in theaters now, and it's in theaters tomorrow. And it's on demand tomorrow and iTunes, all that crap. And Ender's Game in theaters now, made a boatload of money. So congrats, Gavin. And, yeah, I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. And it's been a really good week. It's been a really good month. And 2 weeks away from the drive back to Chicago. And it's exciting. Tomorrow I interview Emil Hirsch and Stephen Burf, and we will be playing that next week. And what else? Pat, is there anything else before I go? I'll stall while Pat writes something. Let's see. We got Emil Hirsch and Stephen Burf tomorrow. And if you haven't seen Prince Avalanche with Emil Hirsch and Paul Rudd, directed and written, directed by David Gordon Green. It's one of the best films of the year. It's in my top five, along with Short Term 12 and Spectacular Now, and you know, The Conjuring. I thought was great, and you know, there's a lot of good stuff. Pat says we got nothing else before midnight, of course, which I think is the best film of the year. Pat says we got nothing else. So Emil Hirsch, Stephen Burf next week. We're going to even have more next week. I don't know what Pat's working on. Pat Tobias is booking his brains out. And I want to thank Cesar Marconi and Pat Tobias for doing this show via satellite with me today. So I will talk to you guys next week. I hope you enjoyed. And as Patty Bell would say, what?